Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, and welcome to Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd with me, Barbara Drew. Today, I'm sitting down with Berry Brothers and Rudd CEO Emma Fox to discuss the role of the wine merchant in a changing world, Emma's journey through the industry, and some of the producers we're lucky enough to work with. Emma, welcome.
Thank you, Barbara. Delighted to be here.
Taken us four seasons, but we have finally managed to pin you down.
Hold me in.
I'm really excited about all of the things we're going to cover today. Let's start from the top. How did you get into the wine industry and end up as CEO of the oldest wine and spirits merchant?
By accident, really, I think would be fair to say. I was at Newcastle University in the late 80s, which shows my age now. And my first part-time job was with Victoria Wine, which some people may remember. And I was a part-time assistant at Victoria Wine. So that's how I got into the world of wine. When I graduated, I then applied for the graduate trainee scheme with Bass. And Bass owned an off-license chain, which is no longer, as indeed Bass is no longer, called Augustus Barnett. And I joined their management trainee, their graduate scheme. And I did a number of different roles, from running an off-license to stock take. And then I arrived at the head office, which was in Silvertown, and I became a buyer for a period of time and didn't leave. I loved it. And I started to do all my WSET exams all the way up to and including diploma. And this whole world of wine completely opened up to me, which was amazing. Absolutely loved it. So at the very tender age of probably 23, I was buying what we called the new world at that time. Wow. So this is the early 90s. So I was in New Zealand, Australia, Chile, Argentina, really before many British buyers, certainly in terms of South America. I think I was probably one of the first British buyers to go over there. I mean, I was, you know, very young, probably very green, but it was absolutely fantastic in Santiago, flying over to Mendoza, meeting those wonderful, wonderful producers. I mean, that's a good, 30 odd years ago, isn't it?
Crikey.
So that's how my journey started. And then I guess over my career, I've had lots of touch points with wines and spirits, whether it's through a supermarket background or whether it's from pubs and hospitality as non-exec directors. So I've always been involved on and off with the industry. Sometimes it's been more of a hobby and other times it's been more of a career, but I just love it. Love it, love it, love it.
I think that's so interesting. Often people go into buying and they have an absolute passion for it, and then that's where they stay. So I think it's really interesting. You've got that expertise, you understand how the business works, but you've also had lots of different roles. So you can really piece together all of the different bits of the jigsaw.
There was one career defining moment for me to exactly that point, Barbara, where Augustus Barnett were being sold to Victoria Wine and I had the opportunity to move with and to Victoria Wine. But I also had an opportunity to stay at Bass and get a big promotion and become a buying manager for a broader area. And that was a real conundrum. And my mentor at the time said to me, well, you will always have wine as a hobby, but I think you can go further. And I think general management now and broadening your horizons is probably the right thing for you to do at this stage. And it was very, very wise words. And that's where I took the sort of more going into general management, but then always having an interest or indeed sometimes an overall P&L responsibility for wines and spirits and therefore a real fascination with it.
Tell us a little bit about your current role. You are CEO, but obviously Berry Brothers and Rudd is a family company. So how do those two things work together side by side?
Across the BB&R portfolio, we obviously have the core business, which most people associate with fine wines and spirits, but we also own a number of other businesses or have majority shareholding or indeed some minority shareholding. So whether it's our importer of artisanal spirits in San Francisco called Hoteling, We have the majority shareholding of that. I chair that business. We've invested in Cotswold Distillery recently. I sit on that board. We have a joint venture with Symington's for Hambledon Vineyards. And so there's a real diverse portfolio, or pretty much within wines and spirits, but quite a diverse portfolio, which is really exciting. So I oversee all of that, or are part of that. I guess answering your question about being the CEO of a family business, family businesses are quite different to any other businesses. And I guess when I worked for Walmart, as much as that's, you know, it was Fortune One, but it was the biggest family business in the world, because it's still a big chunk of the shareholding is the Walton family. And so the values and the culture runs very deep, even though there's 2.2 million employees and 28 countries and so forth. The values of the Walton family are very deep across every colleague. And the same is true here in terms of BBR, far smaller, far fewer colleagues. I guess it comes back to that stewardship word, really, in terms of culture and family values is really, really important. And so being tuned in with what the family are looking for, where their vision is just really important. As a CEO in a family business, you can't just go off and do your own thing. I worked for a private equity before taking this role, and that's very different, time horizons. The CEO very much is obviously responsible, accountable to the board, but you pretty much go on with your own vision and direction. A bit different in a family business.
This word culture, I know it's something that you're particularly passionate about. Tell me a bit more about that, because I think there's the culture that you have in a business, but then there's also the wider culture within an industry. So how do you see the culture within our business? How do you see it in the wine industry as a whole?
That's a very good question. From our point of view, the culture at BB&R, we have three key values. If I just take one of those, passion, I think passion you can absolutely see throughout the whole industry. I think anyone who's involved in fine wines and spirits is just truly passionate. I mean, every day, the passion of our colleagues comes out constantly. And I think whenever you meet people at industry events, or certainly in vineyards, people just have passion, but in the broader sense, for the planet, for people who work there, passion, of course, for the product. And I think that core value, so I've not really thought about that before, our values and the values across the sort of wider industry. And then I think integrity. To me, integrity is about doing the right thing even when no one's looking. I think that just is a moral compass for everybody. And I think that's so important that everybody has integrity in the way that one operates, whether it's operating in the industry or operating with one another or operating in your own business, is really important. The third one, we talk about generosity of spirit, quite an interesting play on words, really. But to me, that's about how people give up their time. We often hear when we have new starters about how welcoming everybody is. When they didn't know something, everyone was very happy to spend time and get people up to speed. And you certainly see that in our industry. Again, you know, going to industry events, people will just take time and they'll spend time tutoring or helping you taste. And I think our values, our family values, are definitely something I think are shared throughout the industry.
I think I would agree with that. As you say, your point to passion, it's an industry where I think it's hard not to be passionate about the product, but as you say, about how it's made, sustainability. Let's be honest, it's very hard work making particularly wines, increasingly hard work with sort of environmental challenges. And you have to have that passion almost to keep you going if you're making this. But again, that generosity of spirit, the sort of hospitality that runs throughout the industry. I find again and again that colleagues in the industry are always willing to go above and beyond to support other people, to give someone a leg up or encourage them into the industry, which I think is lovely.
And I think this warmth, people have a warmth and fun, you know, within generosity of spirit, it's fun. It's such a fun industry. I think that's why I've always had that in my blood, as it were, because it's just great fun. And everybody shares that passion and they have fun doing it. It's great.
The other thing that I think sometimes maybe gets overlooked, it's obviously very much a global industry. And we have got often is in Hong Kong, Singapore, Tokyo, Basingstoke as well, obviously. Tell us a little bit more about how Barry Brothers and Rudd operates internationally and where you see that going in the future.
We sell fine wine and spirits to, I think it's 98, certainly almost 100 countries worldwide, which is a phenomenal footprint, really, phenomenal geographic footprint. But then we have obviously our core offices, as you say, London, Basingstoke, Tokyo, Singapore, and Hong Kong. And it comes back to wherever people are in the world who are passionate about wine, they can be anywhere and collect. So we've got wonderful number of collecting customers who can live anywhere in the world but still enjoy wine, collecting wine. We store it for them in Basingstoke, and then we will ship to wherever the customer would like all over the world. And continuing to see a commonality of interest and thirst for knowledge with customers all over the world. Our first colleague gathering in Asia, where we took our colleagues from the three different offices, we brought them together in Tokyo, we did a presentation, a company update, and we had a great party, sort of impromptu karaoke, bit of dancing. It was fantastic. We had a great fun. And we also had a customer dinner in Hong Kong for our customers over in Asia. And it was just wonderful to be with both the colleagues in Asia, our customers in Asia, and just enjoy each other's company, enjoy the finest of wines and, you know, have fun. It was great. And wherever we go in the world, that's really important that we continue to do that. We continue to enjoy each other's company, understand where the business is going. It's a real opportunity to talk to, specifically in this time in Tokyo, to talk to our colleagues about where the business is going, our five-year plan and all of that sort of thing. It's really important for colleagues to hear that from myself, from Lizzie, face to face, as it were.
Definitely. Something that's always struck me is traditionally the UK has been very much the centre of the wine industry, to some extent the spirits industry as well, partly because we have never really made that much good quality wine ourselves. Yeah. And yet wine has been shipped here from Bordeaux, it's been shipped here from Italy, from around the world. Do you see that changing 5, 10, 20 years into the future? Do you think that the UK's role within the industry will shrink and it will become even more global? Or do you think there'll always be a part for the UK to play?
I think it's a really interesting question, because you're absolutely right. When you go back through history, the UK, well, London had such an enormous role to play in terms of wine and fine wine. So it was almost the epicentre. I think it's probably is likely to become a little less the epicentre, but I think it will always have a magnetic attraction where almost really where it all started in terms of, as you say, Brits didn't produce wine. They had a real love for wine. So there was this magnetic attraction for British people to buy wine, and therefore lots of wine was shipped here. I think going forward, it's definitely much more of a global play. I think it probably comes down to the role of the merchant and how the merchant determines the value it can add to both the producers and the customers that will probably drive whether that continues to be in London, indeed, if the merchant is based in London, or whether that's in other geographies. And I think we've been thinking about this quite a lot. The role of the merchant, we talk about being the closest link between the producer and the customer. And we don't just say that in a trite fashion. We really mean it, because we spend so much time with our producers and indeed so much time with our customers. And it is a marrying of like minds together. And whether it's building brands for our producers and spending time building brands, whether it's spending more time with our customers, really helping them understand their cellar, their collections, the vision for what they would like their cellar to be. I think that role of the merchant is even more important. You know, when we talk to customers, they talk about what they get from us is access to amazing wines. They get entertainment, i.e. coming to these wonderful premises here, and they get exceptional service. And that's what we offer to our customers. But equally, when you talk to producers, it's sort of similar in a similar way. And I think we bring the best out of the producers with whom we work to showcase their fabulous wines and spirits to our customers.
That's a very interesting perspective, because I would guess that a lot of people assume that a wine merchant is very much focused on providing fantastic wines for customers, helping to manage customers' cellars, as you say, educate, host them for events. But actually, this ability to really build those relationships with producers, but almost support, occasionally advise producers as well, that's actually just as important. And I think that happens very much behind the scenes.
Yes.
Something that people may not be as aware of.
Yeah. The buying team spend a lot of time with producers to understand where they want their brands, and more producers are calling their wines their brands, where they want their brands to be, who they want to drink their brands, how they want to communicate. And I suppose often, particularly probably with more of the French producers, the appellation was almost the brand. People knew about a Bordeaux or a Commune, a Margaux, whatever. But now within that, I guess the world is becoming much more competitive at a producer level. you need to market yourself even more. There needs to be a real reason as to why one would want to continue buying a specific chateau or a specific domain. And therefore, I think there's a realization from producers more and more, they can't sit back on their laurels. As the French producers are in competition more and more with producers from California, from Napa, from Sonoma, who have wonderful stories, much younger, but wonderful, wonderful stories that really capture customers' imagination. Actually, it's great because the bar steps up for everybody then, and everybody wants to do a better job. And we can really help with that. And I believe we really do help with that.
It's something I come across quite a lot with wine students. They assume that once you've got a fantastic product, you make this wonderful wine. It's from a Grand Cru vineyard. It's organic and biodynamic, and it's best tasting wine in the world. And they just assume that that is enough for it to be discovered and sold. And in reality, yes, it's very hard work in the vineyard, it's very hard work in the winery, but that really is just the tip of the iceberg. To get that wine into somebody's glass to be able to sell it, there's so much delicious wine out there that simply is undiscovered because we don't have perhaps merchants championing those producers. And it's such a pity because it's wonderful,
liquid. And so I would imagine so much amazing wine is just missed. And, you know, part of our role, the joy of discovery, you know, we just very recently had our Loire campaign. You know, one should never ignore the Loire, as a certain famous person once said. I think that helping customers explore the world of wine so they don't miss out on these amazing regions, that's absolutely our role. But you're right, going from all the hard work in the vineyard and the cellar, bottling, and then those last, I guess, however many yards to the glass.
Yeah.
That's where often it falls down, because people have to be quite loud, have a loud voice in this very busy era to really make themselves known. And that doesn't always happen.
And do you think that's changed over the past 20, 30 years from your time as a buyer to your role now? Have you seen that relationship between merchant and producer evolve?
Yeah, I think what I've seen when I look back over the 30 odd years, some of the new regions, which are huge regions now, were really shouting loudly because they wanted to be heard. You know, whether it was Casino McCull, or I think about various producers I met when I was over in Chile and Argentina so many years ago, and they were knocking loudly at the door, but they were the big producers at the time. Now there are lots and lots and lots of them. And so people are fighting more to be heard and competing. You know, when I was buying, the flying winemaker used to go from Kim Milne or whatever, used to go from New Zealand and pop up to France or wherever. That was few and far between. It happens all the time now. Sometimes, I mean, gosh, you would know this more than anybody, Barbara, but, you know, it's really difficult sometimes to tell which hemisphere the wine's from and where did the winemaker come from.
Yes, when frustratingly so, I must say, if you're doing blind tasting exams.
And so that, in the last 30 years, I mean, the world of wine has become incredibly complicated and even more interesting. But I've certainly seen that difference. I mean, I'm glad I did my diploma 30 years ago and not now. And therefore, every producer has to really think about what they're about and what they want to communicate to the customer about. What's their kind of brand proposition, I suppose, in marketing speak?
Well, as you say, wine has definitely become more complicated. I do recall a master of wine who shall remain nameless discussing when he took the exams and saying, well, it was a Chardonnay. There were only two wines it could have been, really. It was either a Meursault from this vineyard or that vineyard. So I took a plump on that vineyard and I got it right. That simply wouldn't...
the days.
Simply wouldn't be the case nowadays. There is fantastic Chardonnay being made all around the world, and stylistically they can be very difficult to tell apart, partly because weather patterns are changing, but simply because producers are experimenting with different styles, finding what works for them. It's glorious, but can be, as I said, a little frustrating if you're a wine student.
And I guess for us, that's a real opportunity for us to educate, and we find more and more, and particularly with a lot of our customers in Asia, this real thirst for knowledge, this real want to know how's climate change affecting Pinot Noir in Burgundy and what's the latest new grape variety. Or there's this constant thirst for knowledge, which is fantastic, absolutely fantastic. But it means we as a BB&R, as a merchant, need to constantly be out in the vineyards and around the world to know what's going on.
Speaking of changing relationships with producers, you have brought along a delicious looking bottle today for us to taste. It's from Hambledon Vineyard. It's their classic cuvée rosé. We'll open it up in just a minute. But tell us a little bit more about this particular merchant and producer relationship, because it's changed recently.
It has changed very recently, Barbara. Yeah, we were delighted to announce that we have acquired Hambledon Vineyards with the wonderful Symington family estate. So we have a 50-50 joint venture. We bought Hambledon with great excitement. It's a fabulous, fabulous wine. It's grown on absolutely brilliant terroir. The chalky slopes are found in the Côte de Blanc in Champagne. So it is home to, we're talking about Chardonnay, to the best Chardonnay. And there's a big dollop of Chardonnay in this wine we're about to drink. It's very exciting. I mean, Hambledon were the first commercial vineyards in 1952. A gentleman called Major General Sir Guy Salisbury Jones was, I guess, a real pioneer. He planted some vineyards as he looked out of his house window and he looked down the slopes and he said, what should we do with this field then? And in 1952, he planted some vineyards, actually aided by Paul Roger. Yeah, many, many, many years ago. So it's a fabulous product. We absolutely love the quality. It's got so much potential too as well. And I guess it would have been remiss of me if I hadn't brought this beautiful sparkling wine along to try. And I'm a real fan of English sparkling wine.
Well, let's open it up and have a taste and then we can...
You want me to open?
Oh, go on then.
No, you know, you were itching to open. You open. You open, Barbara.
I really dislike opening sparkling wine bottles. They tend to go everywhere. But we'll give it a go. I'll
give it a go.
And then we can have a bit of a chat about
somebody.
English,
I was with somebody and I wasn't paying particular attention. They were opening a wine, a sparkling wine the other day. It was a friend of mine. And she just took the cap off and then she just left it. And then it exploded. And I was like, oh my God. I said, never, never, never do that.
For our listeners, the capsule on the cork, a little metal capsule, and then there's a wire cage, and I can promise you it's not just there for show. Pressure inside the bottle, it's about 6 atmospheres. Once you loosen that wire cage, do make sure that you keep your hand over the cork, because just occasionally they will fly out of the bottle of their own accord. Very carefully twisting the bottle to release
around the cork. Oh, what a super sound, Barbara. Well done. Fabulous.
There we go. The first thing to note here, this is a beautiful, I'd say it's almost partridge eye colour, or onion skin. Yeah. That's slightly dusky salmon, so a relatively pale pink. And it's actually in a beautiful clear bottle as well, so you can really see the gorgeous colour there. As Emma mentioned, this is predominantly Chardonnay. It's 86% Chardonnay and 14% Pinot Noir, which gives it the beautiful colour. Something that they do is they age their wine for really quite a long time. On the lees. So the lees are the gunky yeast cells that are left at the end of the second fermentation. The second fermentation here happens in bottle. It happens in the very same bottle that you buy and open to drink the wine. So it's traditional method and the same method that they use in Champagne. And this has been aged for nearly 4 years.
Nearly 4 years, yeah.
Quite a long time. Mm. And that gives you a lovely, toasty, we often use the word brioche.
Brioche, yeah. There's definitely a toastiness.
Quite a posh pastry there for anyone who likes their
I think I'm getting more
bread.
Warburton's white bread. No, toasted.
But yes, this lovely sort of patisserie and bready, cakey note. But as well as that, there's beautiful fruit character. Red currant, cranberry, red cherry, what we might describe as quite crunchy red fruit.
Yes, fresh. Yeah.
Obviously, lots of beautiful bubbles. Give it a taste and see what we think. Really nice texture there. Now, often in the wine trade, when we talk about sparkling wine, we suddenly go off-piste and start talking about mousse. Is it an aggressive mousse or a foamy mousse? That just means bubbles. But the bubbles are really nice.
Yeah, lovely. It's very elegant.
Yeah, very, very sort of smooth. They don't hurt your tongue in any way. And that's partly because of the long aging here. And just layers of flavour that come through.
Absolute layers of flavour. Absolutely beautiful. Very elegant and a lovely length on the finish.
Yes. Really those flavours really, really unfurl. A little bit of citrus, lots of red fruit character, and then these wonderful, wonderful toasty flavours that come through on the finish.
Very drinkable, even at 11
Absolutely.
O'clock.
Absolutely. Wonderful acidity here. We know that acidity tends to be quite high in cooler climates, so it's something that English sparkling wine has a lot of, offset by about 10 grams per litre of dosage. So that's the final little adjustment of sugar that goes into the bottle before it is sent out. A touch higher than you might find in some champagnes, but just really balances all of
but
those flavours.
But balances it beautifully, actually. I thought the same, a touch higher than one would normally expect, but actually it marries very well, doesn't it?
Yeah, really just helps to highlight those lovely fruit notes. Yeah, really lovely. Every time that I taste English sparkling wine, I am reminded of the quality and the complexity. Even compared with 5 years ago, 10 years ago, these wines can absolutely hold their own against champagne, which is very exciting.
It really is. And I guess for us, having made this very recent acquisition, it's hugely exciting for us because we can just see this. This is mainly 2017, I think, vintage. Talking almost 6 years ago now. Every year gets better and better and better. And the flying winemaker, if you will, at Hambledon, I think, as you probably know, Barbara, is Hervé Gestin from Le Clos Briand. And he is just one of the world's experts in sparkling wine and champagne. We're privileged to be able to work with him at Hambledon.
Absolutely. He's doing some wonderful things at Le Clos Briand, really pushing the boundaries and how to make an incredible champagne, how to make it as sustainably as possible, how to really coax those most interesting flavours out of the grapes and out of the wine.
Yeah.
So it will definitely be interesting to see what lies ahead.
And its evolution.
It's interesting you mentioned the base wine for this is 2017. Obviously, over the past 5 years, the reputation of English sparkling wine has been increasing year on year. There are a lot of vineyards being planted now, but volumes are increasing relatively slowly, actually. Mm. And one of the challenges that we will have to think about in the UK when it comes to our sparkling wine is our weather.
Yes.
It's always been abysmal. Mm. It doesn't seem to be getting much better, to be honest. It's just a different shade of abysmal.
Different shade of grey.
Now we get frost later than we used to, which is a problem.
And heat earlier than we used to.
Exactly. And it might be hot in the summer, but 40 degrees isn't really the sort of heat that you want. And so actually in 2022, volumes were not much higher than they were 5 years previously. This variability is a bit of a problem for the English wine industry because it means we're never quite sure whether it's going to be a great year with a bumper crop or actually not a very good year at all. And at the moment, I mean, we're producing about 12 million bottles a year of wine in the UK, which is still a drop in the ocean when compared
with champagne. We drink 30 million bottles of champagne as a nation.
That sounds about right. Yeah, yes. Yeah, we are.
So we've got some way to go because I do believe it's a contender. Sorry to our champagne houses. It is absolutely a contender.
100%. Partly because it's a newer wine region. We've got the opportunity for that experimentation, not having to stick to quite such strict rules.
Yes, that's true.
Interesting that the very best English producers do follow the champagne approach in terms of aging, in terms of production, but actually they don't have to if they don't want to. So that's something that will be interesting to look at in the coming years.
Absolutely. I'm delighted with this. I think it's terrific.
Probably shouldn't say it's a nice breakfast wine, but certainly a good elevensies wine.
Always worked for Winston, didn't it?
Indeed. Where do you see then English sparkling wine going? Do you think it will be a small but very high-end competitor to champagne? Do you think it's going to go down the Prosecco route as more wineries come on board?
I really hope it doesn't go down the Prosecco route. I think the care and attention and quality of English sparkling wine means that it absolutely can compete with the best champagne houses. And I think we must be confident about that. It must continue to command a premium price and be thought of in the realms of, do I buy a sparkling wine from France or a sparkling wine from England? One happens to be champagne, one happens to be English sparkling wine. I think the opportunity to really celebrate, to gift, you know, all the occasions that one would buy champagne for, I think absolutely English sparkling wine can do that. And that's certainly what we'd be looking to do with make it a very viable and high quality alternative to a champagne drinking occasion.
So this is the first vineyard that we've owned in the many years that we have been around. Is that correct?
It is, Barbara, yeah. Over 325 years, the first time Berry Brothers and Rudd have owned a vineyard.
Do you think this is going to be the start of a move into large-scale wine
Let's
production?
Let's see how this goes first. I mean, which is why it's fabulous to be partnering with the Symingtons, because they do know a thing or two about vineyards in Portugal. So we're very lucky to be partnering with them. Let's see how this goes, and then we may decide what we want to do in the future.
Going back to your earlier comments about your role and all of the different boards that you sit on, customers, they'll come into number 3 St. James's Street or a shop just around the corner on Pall Mall, and they're often surprised by what lies beneath. We've got nearly 2 acres of cellars on the site here, and we do lots of wonderful events, and there's this extra layer that many people are unaware of. And it feels as though if you peel back the idea of the wine merchant, there's an awful lot that goes on behind the scenes. We've got vineyards, there's distilleries, there's our spirits business in San Francisco. Does this make us the most complicated business in the wine and spirits industry?
Perhaps I might change the word complicated to interesting. I think it gives us real breadth, and I think it gives us that opportunity to be able to benchmark best practice, find out what's going on in other areas, because we're more involved, because we either have a seat at the table or we're invested. And I think it's really important that we learn from other people, and we learn from other countries, and we learn from other amazing producers and big spirits companies, because there's always so much to learn. And I think one should never be arrogant. One should always be looking to see how we can do things better. And I think having the portfolio that we have really gives us that insider opportunity to do that, and for us to just keep getting better and better and better.
We've spoken about English sparkling wine, we've touched on port, and of course you've spoken about South America. Are there any other wine regions that you are particularly passionate about?
There are lots of wine regions I love. I do love my white wines from Burgundy. My father was very into his wine going back a long time ago. I remember, you know, the bottle of Mouton Cadet would come out on the table on a Sunday lunchtime when we had the roast beef. And then when I was probably in my teens, my father used to go skiing, and he used to drive down to wherever it was in France with a friend of his, always via Burgundy. Now, at the time, I didn't really know why he was so excited about it, but the trip would always have to coincide with a visit, and they'd go in Hospice de Beaune, or they'd go in Gevry. And to this day, my father has the most enormous love of Burgundy wines, which I think has rubbed off a little bit on me. I only wish he'd started collecting then, because we're going back some way and he would have had the most amazing cellar. I do absolutely love my white Burgundies, and from many producers. I'm not beholden to any one or two amazing producers. You and I have talked about this before. I'm always a fan of the New World, as it's, I don't think it's probably called that anymore, is it? So really brilliantly made Sauvignon Blanc. I just think a classic Sauvignon Blanc, you can't beat. A classic Chenin. I mean, classic Riesling.
Very underrated.
So I'm not answering the question well at all, because I've just kind of morphed into all of these. But
wine.
Wine. Classically made, beautiful quality. Yeah.
And is there a particular bottle in your cellar that you're really looking forward to uncorking one day?
When Ikem launched in 2019, probably just a year, 18 months ago, I was lucky enough to meet the producer at the time, the winemaker at the time, and we hosted a dinner here in the cellars. And because the vintage was a little bit tricky for them, they had a much higher percentage of Sauvignon Blanc in the blend than they would ordinarily have. I think I'm right in saying it's 45% from memory, which meant that it's a terrific wine as an aperitif. Now, we always think about Ikem being at the end of a beautiful dinner and kind of a lovely sort of full stop to the end of a fabulous dinner with friends. But it made me think of it in a completely different way. And to enjoy Ikem as an aperitif was quite an eye-opener. And so I have a case of that sitting in my cellar. And when the time is right, I will enjoy it as an aperitif.
Fantastic. That sounds absolutely delicious. Well, thank you so much, Emma. It's been a fascinating conversation. Hopefully it hasn't been too terrifying.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd. If you'd like to browse the producers mentioned in today's episode, visit bbr.com/podcast. Or, if you're interested in starting your own fine wine collection with Berry Brothers and Rudd, all the information you need can be found on bbr.com/collecting. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you again for listening. I'm off to track down some more English sparkling wine. Cheers.